And we're holding Ein Ches Amud Bey's third line from the bottom. We started talking about Nichsim Malug, that the woman gets property during the marriage and what the dinim are about her when she can sell it and there's no problem with it, when she can sell it and the husband has the right to undo the sale. So now that brings the Gemara into a related point. Which is also going to tie in the end, which we said in the Mishnah that Shimon had drawn a distinction between Nechasim that you're doing a Baal, Nechasim that the husband knew about versus Nechasim that he didn't, where we had two definitions in the Gemara of what that means, Karka versus Metalplin, or Karka here versus out of town. So now the following story in the Gemara is going to bear on that. The Gemara says, Ahi itza deboyed tivrechinu lemichsam gavra. There was a certain woman who wanted to prevent her husband from being able to, her future husband, from being able to get her nechasim. What happened was, this was a woman, she was an almana, she had previously been married, she had a daughter from her previous marriage, now she was going to remarry. Normally her husband would not only be entitled to payrus from her karka, but also he would yarshin her when she dies. She didn't want that. This woman didn't want that. So instead, she wanted to keep that away from her husband. So she wrote out a document saying that she's giving these nechasim to her daughter. She wrote out a document giving these nechasim to her daughter. Now, Rashi says that she actually informed the Edim when she wrote the Shtar that this is not a real matana, she's only doing it in order to be mavriach, and not that the daughter should actually herself, if the woman herself, if her husband dies before her, that the daughter should be able to keep the property, or divorces her, that the daughter should be able to keep the property. Rashi says she actually informed the Edim ahead of time. Tosfos doesn't like that explanation because the Gemara is going to be discussing now whether the gift is valid. If she informed the Edom ahead of time, of course it's not valid. So Tosfos says she didn't actually say anything, but it was obvious from the situation. So the question is whether it's valid or not. Tosfos Rid actually says that there's a mistake in the text of Rashi, and it's supposed to be that she did not inform the Edom. And then there's some discussion among Rishonim and Achronim about the ins and outs of it. Maybe Rashi means that she told them when the shtar was first being written, but she didn't reiterate that when the shtar was being given, or all kinds of different possibilities like that they talk about. Anyway, eventually, in Siva v'Igarsha, eventually she was married, and then later on she was divorced. Now she wanted the property back. So she came to Reb Nachman to say that, after all, the whole thing was only to be mavriach, in order to hide the nechasim from her husband. She never actually meant to give it free and clear to the daughter, and therefore she wants it back now that she got divorced. Sure enough, Rav Nachman accepted her argument and ripped up the shtar matana, in other words, to say that now the daughter doesn't have a claim to the property anymore. The mother, this twice over almana now, or now she's a grusha or whatever, is entitled to take it back. So Rav Onan went to Ma'ukva to complain about it. Now Ma'ukva was the Reish Galusa at the time. He was also the head of the Beis Din in Nahada. So it's Ma'ukva's responsibility to make sure that everything is being done according to halacha. Omale, so Rav Onan says to Ma'ukva to complain. He says, Chozi Mar, look, Rebbe, Nachman the farmer, which is like he's using that in a derogatory sense to say he's not even expert in dinim. Heichim Makara Shtari Dinji. How, look at this, he's going and ripping up people's shtaris. How could he do that? Which, by the way, this is a classic example of, and now we know, of course, you know, Lashon Hara is pretty serious, but this is a classic example of L'Te'elis, where Lashon Hara is being said for a constructive purpose. Rav Onan, who thought that Rav Nachman had acted wrongly, is going to Ma'ukva, who is the Abbeis Din, to get the matter taken care of. Omalei, so Ma'ukva tells him, Emily Izzy, tell me, Izzy, Gufa de Ubda Hechahava, how did this actually happen? We learned before that there's two meanings that we're showing him say of the word Izzy in a number of places, not over here, but in a number of places, Rashi says that Izzy means my friend, and the Rashbam says that it means like in English, like a filler word, like you would say now or then or so or something like that. Anyway, so what was it? Gufa de Ogra Hechihava? What was the whole story? Tell me the background behind Rav Nachman ripping up the shtap. Omale Hachi Vahachihava. So Rav Onan tells him the whole story. So Ma'ukva says, oh, so you're not just talking about a regular shtar and you're saying that Rav Nachman doesn't know what he's doing. Shtar Mavrachas, comrade. You're talking about a shtar Mavrachas, exactly this, which is, she wrote the shtar to begin with only in order to conceal the property from her husband and to prevent her husband eventually yarshing it. Shitaka never meant that it should be a sincere gift. You should know. Hachi Amar Rav Chaniloi Bar Idi Amar Shmuel. You should know, says Ma'ukva, Rav Chaniloi Bar Idi said in the name of Shmuel, Moira Hira Ani, I am a Moira Hira. I have, Rashi explains, Shmuel is saying, I have permission from the Reish Kavosah of Shmuel's times, who presumably before even Ma'ukva, I have permission from the Reish Kavosah to judge. And obviously the Reish Kavosah would give that permission only to somebody who knows what he's talking about. And I say, says Shmuel, Im yavish shtam avrachas v'yodi ekrenu. If I ever get a hold of a shtam avrachas, I would tear it up because it's true. She only meant it to be mavriach, and therefore it's not considered valid. And therefore, Rav Nachman was correct in following Shmuel's precedent and ripping it up. This moira hayra ani. There are Rishonim who the Ritva brings a different gusa, not moira but mi yirei. I am, Shmuel says, I'm one of the ones who fears to paskin on new things, usually on novel situations. Usually I paskin according to what I receive from my Rebbeim, and I don't necessarily try on my own to just apply them to new situations, but I am so certain of this din, says Shmuel, that I would be willing to rip up such a shtar. So therefore, it's a good shtar. Nachman is following that precedent, so Ma'ukva says to Rav Onan, don't worry about it. Rav Nachman did the right thing. Okay. So the Gemara says, Amalei Rava le Rav Nachman. So Rava asked Rav Nachman, after all, is that really correct? Does that really apply to this case? Time of my, after all, why is Shmuel saying that he would rip up a shtar mavrachas? Because we can assume a person is not going to leave all his property to somebody else and give it to somebody else. After all, again, the whole purpose of it is to prevent, in this case, she wants to prevent her husband from yarshing it. But fine, you could say, hani mili la'achrini. That applies when it's being given to a completely third party. Then you could say she's not intending to be maknet complete. Avalit zrata yahiva. But after all, to her daughter, maybe she is willing to, it's her own daughter after all, maybe she is willing to give it as a complete gift. So fine, Rav Nachman, you're saying that Shmuel says, shtar mavrachas, you rip up, but maybe Shmuel is only talking about when she gave it to some third party, not to some stranger or something, not when she gave it to her own daughter. And Rav Nachman answers him, no, after the hochavim, pem brata, nafsha adifala. True, it is her daughter, but even so, even when you're talking about her daughter, she would still prefer for herself, she would still prefer to have the property for herself, even over her daughter, and therefore, yes, we have every right to assume, says Rav Nachman, that this shtar mavrachas is the same as any other, and therefore that the daughter is not entitled to nechasim. Like this, the deal would have been that the point of giving them to the daughter was only so that if the husband dies before her, or rather if she dies before her husband, then her husband shouldn't yarshin it. But other than that, we consider it like any other shtar mavrachas, and we don't allow the matana to stand. So the Gemara asks, Mesli, I have a contradiction to that. A braisa says, Haroitza shetavriach nechaser mibayla, suppose that a woman does want to hide this property from her husband. Kate said he oisa. How can she do it? So Rav Shimon Gamliel says what she can do is she can write a shtar pasim. A shtar pasim, we had this word earlier in the Masechta, in the second parak. Usually what it means is a shtar pasim is, for example, that you're writing a shtar, you haven't yet, for example, to borrow money, you haven't yet borrowed the money, but you're going to work on talking the person, pasim, aloshin pius, you're going to work on talking the person into lending you the money. Here, Rashi says, then it means similarly that she's she's talking this other person into accepting this gift just for this purpose of mavrachas, but not that he should keep it permanently. Shitim Mokubetzis brings an interesting idea from Rashi Ksaviad, who said that Rashi, the first version of Rashi's Pirush on this Masechta, which is that what she actually does is she says to the person, you know what, for your trouble, I'm even willing to pay you a little bit of money. That's the passive involved. Anyway, the point is that, so Rav Shimon Gamliel says she writes a shtar pasim, but the Chacham say that doesn't work. If she writes out such a shtar, then in fact the recipient could laugh at her. If he wants to keep this property, he would be able to laugh at her and say, tough luck, you wrote me a shtar. I have a perfectly valid shtar in my possession and you can't undo it. So that's what we're saying. That contradicts what Shmuel says, that I would rip up such a shtar. And now we're not going to say Shmuel is going to go like Rav Shimon Gamliel, because, of course, the halacha is going to be like the rabbin, like the chachamim. So what do the chachamim say? So how can she make it work? She would have to write in the shtar that this property belongs to you as of now, meaning retroactively, but only when I agree. So now the point is, so now this works as a havracha. So now if her husband wants it, then she's going to say that I do want the gift to be valid, and therefore it takes effect retroactively. And if the one who she gave the shtar to says, I want it, then she's going to say, I don't want it. So therefore that makes it work. And in fact, Mephoshim point out that therefore, like, both of them are going to have to be on their toes around her, because they both know that if they provoke her or whatever, then she's going to say whatever it is, and it's going to go to the other person. So therefore, both of them are going to be careful, and the result is that it actually ends up being kept away from her husband, but nevertheless preserved for her. So the implication is time of the cost for lehachi. Only when she writes that kind of lashon, mahayom alach she'erze, doesn't work. Hole kost for lehachi, implying if she didn't write something like that, kanoni lekeach. Then according to the chachamim, the lekeach fully buys it. So now, how is Shmuel saying that any shtam of rachas we rip up, even though, for example, in the case that Shmuel is talking about, or in the story that we had with Reb Nachman, such a thing was not written in the shtar. It was just written flat out as a gift. So the answer is, Amar Abaya, sorry, I skipped a couple of lines. The answer is, Amar Abzera, like Kasha, Haba Kula, Haba Miktsasa. There's no contradiction. Shmuel and Reb Nachman are talking about when she wrote all of her nechassim away. So now we have to figure she wouldn't want to leave herself without any nechassim at all if she gets divorced, or if she gets widowed. So therefore we can say Anan Sadi, we ourselves are Edim that she wouldn't have wanted to do that, and therefore that she didn't mean for the gift to take fully to take effect fully. As opposed to if she didn't use all of the, if she didn't use this mavrachas for all of her nechassim, only for some of them, then we can say that she did mean to do it, because after all, she's not leaving herself completely penniless, and then only if, then she would have to write nusach in the shtar that the chachamim are saying she'd have to write mehayoyim olach she'eretze. Okay. So the Gemara asked, So if you're telling me, according to Shmuel, then the fact is we're still calling it Havracha, implying that it has a certain effect. So fine, what we're saying is, in other words, Shmuel considers it's not a valid matana, and the woman is entitled to it back if she gets divorced, but the implication is that up to some point, it does work as a shtar Havracha. So the question is, v'ilei kenani lekeach, if according to Shmuel, the lekeach has not acquired the property at all, because we're talking about where it was the whole thing, and where it was all of her property, and Shmuel says, therefore, that shtam avrachas like that we would rip up, nikninu baal, then instead the husband should be koneh them in the regular way where he gets payers from them. So why are we even calling it a shtar avracha? In other words, what is Shmuel saying when he says we rip up the shtar? He means that if the woman wants the property back, then she can get it. But what's been the status of it until now? Did it belong to the woman? Or then in that case, her husband should be entitled to pay us from it, like any other property of hers. Did it belong to the other person? Well, if it belonged to the other person, then obviously that doesn't change now. So why is Shmuel even, so even Shmuel is implying that there's a certain validity to this shtar. He's just saying that she has the right to undo the matana. So again, either if it was all the nechassim, she doesn't need to write any special lashon, and according to, and if it was some of the nechassim, then she'd need to write mehayom loch she'eretzah. So what's the story with the nechassim in between? Amar Abaya asom ki nechassim she'en yaduim labal ba'al libud Reb Shimon. The answer is Abaya says because we treat them like nechassim that the husband didn't know about, because after all, the husband was under the impression that this is a fully valid matana. He doesn't know this whole thing. He doesn't necessarily know this whole thing about Shmuel's din and about the brisa and everything. As far as he knows, his wife wrote out previously a shtar giving away this property to somebody else. As far as he knows, it's a fully valid matana. So it's considered like nechassim that the husband didn't know about. Valibadid of Shimon, and then that would follow Reb Shimon, where again, Reb Shimon and the Mishnah had distinguished between nechassim that the husband knew about, where he's entitled to Paris, versus nechassim that he didn't know about, where we said nechassim, Ayidurin Labal, the husband can undo the sale, because he can say, I have the rights to Paris, and therefore you can't sell it without my permission, as opposed to, he said, nechassim she'en yadurin labal, she could sell or give whatever she wants, and it would be fine, because he didn't know about it anyway. So in this case, since there was a matana involved, so he doesn't know that these nechassim are in fact, that he would be in line to pay us of these nechassim, and therefore therefore we can consider that the sale is valid to that extent, such that he doesn't get paid us for them. So Tosfos brings from Rabbi Nechananel, in that case, that must mean the halacha is like Reb Shimon. And then Tosfos goes on to discuss, is that in fact the case? And different Rishonim talk about, in fact, is the halacha like Reb Shimon, in that, the final decision is that, yes, we do distinguish between Nechassim Ayidu and Labal and Nechassim She'en Yidu and Labal, as in this story, and we say, therefore, that when they're Einim Yidu and Labal, then the husband doesn't get paid for them. There is a good deal of discussion also among the Shonim about some other ins and outs of the Gemara over here. Do we say, for example, is the lekeach meanwhile entitled to paters in between? One thing we have to figure out is what in fact was her intention with this gift. Was it strictly from avrachas? Did she mean to give the other person any rights to? So there's quite a bit of discussion about various ins and outs of the story of avrachas. Okay, Mishnah says. What happens now? Let's start talking about different kinds of property that she may get during the marriage. So if she inherited money, now the usual rule, of course, is we say that the husband is entitled to payrus from his wife's nechassim. So now, for example, if she inherited money, then how do we deal with that as far as payrus? Now, one obvious possibility, we could say, okay, so let the husband invest the money and let him use the proceeds from it. The thing is that's risky. We do want to have that the husband is entitled to keres, but we want to make sure as much as possible that the keren, the actual asset itself, is going to be preserved for the woman. Because after all, if her husband dies before her or divorces her, then she's entitled to the keren back. And even if she dies before him, then the Karen still has to become part of the estate. So we're not talking about where it's written into the Tzuba. If it was, then you have Tzuba's Benin Dichrin, that's something else. But no, here we're talking about Nifsim Malug. But still, the fact is, there's always the possibility that the husband might die before her or might divorce her, and then she's entitled to the Karen. So therefore, the bottom line is we want to preserve the Karen as much as possible. So, not the luck something. So the Mishnah says, if she inherited money, or inherited or otherwise came into money, what we do is, we use that money to buy a piece of land, and then he gets paid us from that land. What happens if she got a hold of payers that are already detached from the ground? The same thing, Yilokach ben Karka, Voyach HaPeres, those also are considered like Peres, and therefore we buy other Karka with them, and he eats the Peres of that Karka. Now, what happens, Peres HaMchoborim B'Karka? What happens if she inherits or otherwise comes into payrus that are still attached to the gwen? So what do we consider them? Do we consider those keren or do we consider those payrus? Amar Rav Meir, so Rav Meir says what we do is shomen oisa kamei yofa payrus kamei yofa b'lo payrus. What we do is now she herself doesn't own the character necessarily. So what we do is we are talking about over here with a character. We are talking about where the character belongs to her, but we're talking about now we have the character with the payrus attached. So the character itself is no question is considered the keren, and in future years he'll get payrus from it. But let's say now she inherited it and it's already full of payrus. So Amar Rav Meir, shomin oisa kamei yofa b'payrus, the kamei yofa b'lo payrus. Rav Meir says instead of figuring out the value of the payrus themselves, what we do is we figure out the difference in value between the karka with the payrus and without it. Because Rashi explains that Rav Meir says whatever grew when it was in his rishus after she inherited this field is considered payrus, but everything that grew before that is considered part of the keren. So therefore, we need to figure out how much is the what's the difference in the value with and without the payrus, moiser, and then the remainder, the extra over that, you lockach ben character for oichal payrus. We buy other character with it, and he eats the payrus of that. So in other words, so we have this field without payrus, it's worth 100. With payrus, it's worth 130. In future years, of course, he's going to get the payrus from the original $100 character. Meanwhile, what we do is with the 30 extra dollars. With the 30 extra dollars that such a field would fetch if we were to sell it full of payrus, then we buy another piece of character with it, and he continues to eat the payrus of that. Right. So in other words, Rav Meir holds that the payrus that she inherited attached to the ground are considered keren. So then we have to have payrus of those payrus somehow. So that's how we work it.
And you can't say the $30 goes to her.
No, because the whole point is that it's nichsim lug. So the general rule is that any assets that she brings into the marriage are going to become either nichsitzin barzel or nichsim lug. Unless now there can be cases where, for example, she receives something on manas that her husband doesn't have reshus in it. There are such cases. We're going to talk about them later in the Masechta. But ordinarily the principle is anything that was actually in the marriage at the time, anything that was an asset of hers at the time of the marriage and is written into the ksuba and the husband takes full responsibility for it is nichsim malug, meaning that he's entitled even to the keren. He just has to reimburse her later, and anything that's not is nichsim malug, and he's entitled to payrus. Given that we said the chachamim made the takana that he's entitled to payrus from her assets in order that in return for the fact that if she gets captured, he's going to ransom her. So therefore, whenever possible, we want to make sure that he's going to be getting his payrus.
So,
because that's the thing. Rav Meir holds that the payrus that she inherited are actually considered keren because they grew before it ever came into her possession. In other words, the same way, for example, the previous line of the Mishnah said that let's say she inherited only payrus that detached from the ground. So let's say, for example, you know, her father passed away and he left a crate of oranges and she inherited that. There's no question that those are considered keren. So what can we do? How do you get payrus from that? So then we sell them and we use them to buy karka. So the mayor is saying the same thing applies if the payrus was still attached to the ground, but they grew outside of the husband's use.
So if the wife says, God, I don't care, you will keep it for our family, use it, does he have to sell it?
Yeah, well, because ultimately the point is that we need to find, but we may eat them for the family, okay, but the point is we still need to have a keren from what she inherited. Look, I mean, if they both mutually agree, then of course they can do whatever they want, but we're talking about if the husband is insisting, look, you know, this is keren, and I should be entitled to payrus of it. So how do we arrange for payrus? We do it that way. That's what we're going to discuss in the Gemara, yeah. It means any kind of asset. The general idea is almost any kind of asset can produce payrus. Either you have, for example, if it's a field, you have actual produce from it. If it's a house, then you have, let's say, the rental income from it. If it's an eved, we're going to talk about on Omid Beis, then, for example, you have the fact that the eved can work for you. That's considered payrus. And so forth. Any kind of asset you have, the actual asset itself, and then you have what you can accomplish with it.
Difference
between Tzoyn Barzel and the other one is... So Nichsit Tzoyn Barzel, again, to recap, Nichsit Tzoyn Barzel means that the husband takes full achrayus for them. He is entitled to use, he's entitled to the actual keren bit. All it is if he dies before her, or if he divorces her, then he has to return her the keren, and if it's gotten lost or depreciated or whatever, then he has to reimburse her for the difference. As opposed to nichse melug, melug literally means plucking. So the idea is the keren of it doesn't belong to the husband at all. The keren of it, the actual asset belongs to the wife, but he is entitled to peiros of it as long as the marriage lasts. So for example, let's say with a field. Nichsetzen Barza would mean the field is worth 100. So the husband is accepting on himself that if I divorce her, then I'm gonna give her back this field or else I'm gonna reimburse her $100. Nichsemalug would be that we'd say the field belongs to you, the wife. However, the payers of it, as long as we're married, belongs to me. If when the marriage is over, then you keep the karka, then you have the karka. It was hers all along. Yeah.
And this all depends how you write it.
So what it is nixitza and bazel are written into the ksuba, and the husband accepts achrayus for them. You know, we have in our present day ksubas, if you look in the nusach over there, you have
some big words.
You have some big words over there. Yeah, but you have there's the ikuk suba, 100 for a non basula, 200 for a basula. Then you add over there with svi. Then you write over there with den midunia dan olas mibeyavua. You write the following is the midunia which he's bringing in from her father's house, then kesef and zav and kachitin, silver, gold ornaments, etc. Then we say a kol kibul olav. Chasan Danan, the Chosin, has accepted responsibility for all of that. The Masayim is cooking Kesef Tzoruch, and he's taking on a Shibud on that. So he's saying, I accept that the value of all those assets she's bringing into the marriage is 200 cooking of silver, and he's taking responsibility to repay them, to give back the original Mechosim, or to repay them as the case may be. Those are Nichsa Tzoyin Baris. That's what he's saying. Yeah, when the marriage is over, if he divorces her or dies.
Do they need to make an assessment of all these?
No, well, in the olden times, they would actually make an assessment, and it would actually be customized per ksuba. But nowadays, we pretty much just have a standard nusach. Anyway, so that's what Meir says. This is what we have to do. Any fruit, any produce that was attached to the ground when she inherited the property, those are considered peiros directly, so therefore he's directly entitled to those. Only any produce that was detached from the ground, shalah, then that belongs to her, and like we said before, if she inherits money, for example, and in that case, and we use that to buy karka, and he gets peiros from that. But the peiros that exist at the time in the field that are attached to the ground at the time when she inherits it, the chamsei are actually considered peiros rather than keren, and therefore he's entitled to them directly, without having to sell them and so forth. Reb Shimon Omer, Rav Shimon says, "Mokum sheyofa koicha b'knisasa hura koicha b'tziyasa." You have to consider, says Rav Shimon, that you have something where he has a stronger position, where he has a greater koyach when he marries her, but the parallel situation when she leaves. If he divorces her, then he has the worst of it. And vice versa, makam shahura toicha b'knisasa yofa koicha b'tziyasa. And vice versa, something that he has less rights to when he marries her, he would have greater rights to when he divorces her. What does that mean? Ketzad, Reb Shimon says, peirasam choborim lakarka. If when she inherited the property, there were peiros attached to the ground, b'knisasa shaloi, when he marries her and the peiros were attached to the ground at the time, or when the asset came to her during the marriage, then the peiros belong to her, like the Chachamim said, which the Gemara is going to ask in that case. It seems to be saying exactly the same as the Chachamim. What is he adding, except to give us a handy way to remember it? But anyway, so we'll see in the Gemara. On the other hand, if he divorces his wife, and the Chosim had peiros that were still attached to the ground, then she gets to keep the karka together with those peiros. So when they're attached to the ground, at the beginning, he has the stronger position. He's entitled to those peiros. But later on, when he divorces her, then he's not entitled to them. But tlushim min hakarka, when the fruit is detached from the ground, then it's the other way around. B'knisasa shalah, when it first comes into the marriage, then it would be hers. And then, in other words, it would be considered keren, like you said, and we sell it, and we use that to buy another piece of karka, from which the husband will get peiros, or we'd see also shaloi, but then If he divorces her, then those payrus belong to him, because after all, the payrus are nisimalor. So Reb Shimon
but he worked on that. He was the one that was working the field.
Well, it didn't really matter who was working in the field. The fact is, he has the right to payrus from her nechassim, whether he worked it, whether she worked it, whoever it is, or whether that sharecropper or whatever. The point is that so Reb Shimon seems to be restating what the Tanakhama what the Chachamim said against Reb Meir, and just saying it in an easier to remember way. So the Gemara is going to explain what exactly is the machlokes between them.
So the idea is
the husband is entitled to payrus as long as the marriage exists, right? But so now Reb Shimon is saying, if the payrus are still mechubal karka, then we don't consider them payrus. We consider them the actual asset itself. Therefore, if he divorces her and there are payrus attached to the ground, then he doesn't have any right to it because they're part of the keren, and the keren all along belonged to her. Yeah. But if they were detached from the ground, then they're like any other payrus, and he's entitled to keep them. Okay. So the Gemara starts off. Pshita.
When it says you look up for him, she gets money.
Yeah.
So what? She has to spend the money?
So what we're saying is we have to get some kind of asset with that money that the husband can get paid with that.
The money itself is not an asset?
Well, the money itself can be an asset in the sense, for example, we could say the husband could invest it and have profits from it. The problem with that is, as the Gemara is going to say now, we want to have as much as possible something where the keren will be preserved as much as possible. If we invest money, after all, the whole investment can go down the drain, and then not only the payrus are gone, so is the keren. Again, obviously, if they mutually agree, they can agree between themselves whatever they want. If the husband has a business, and he asks his wife to invest the money in the business, and she agrees, fine, gesunt hate. She's willing to take that chance. But we're talking about if they can't agree on that, then the fact is we have to make sure that the keren is preserved for her as much as possible. So the Gemara says, pshita. Now, here's some dinim that are obvious in that connection. Ara uvati. Suppose that she inherited money. When I say inherited, by the way, it means any other kind of case where she came into money, where we have these dinim. It doesn't mean, by the way, for example, she found money. We said before, Metzia goes to her husband, period. But we're talking about, so it could be an inheritance, it could be a gift, it could be whatever. Anyway. Nafu little means it fell to her. So usually that means Birusha, like her father or some other relative passed away, and then the following property fell to her. Metzia is something else. The husband is entitled to her Metzia. We learned previously that Mishum Eva, because otherwise it would create bad feelings between them. Yeah. No, that's not called Neifa, yeah. So the Gemara says, Pshita, it's obvious that Ara Uvaki, suppose that she inherited money, and now they're disagreeing, what should we do with it? He wants to use it to buy land, which we can then plant and get paid us from it. She says, instead, I want to buy with the houses, and we'll rent them out, or vice versa. So then, Ara, then the din is, whichever one is saying we want to buy the land is what we do. Because after all, the land is not going to go bad. You get payrus out of it every year. It's not going to go bad. So as opposed to a house, for example, can fall down or other things can happen where then the keren as a whole is gone. So therefore land would be preferable. Land can burn, but even if the land burns or even if it gets destroyed by disease or whatever, the land is still there. Eventually it'll regenerate. Eventually it'll recover. But a house falls down, for example, yeah. So Rashi explains, in other words, on the one hand, you know, one of them, the husband might be saying, I want something that gives greater payrus. You get more payrus, let's say, out of a piece of land than you do out of a house that you rent. On the other hand, she has the point. If he wants to buy a house, she can say, the fact is, a house depreciates over time, land doesn't, and therefore I don't want that. So then, yeah. Similarly, Bati Vidikri, similarly, if one of them wants to buy a house and the other one wants to buy palm trees, where palm trees eventually are going to dry up, so then we buy houses. Dikri Vilani, if it's a choice between palm trees and other kinds of trees, Ilani, then we got other kinds of trees because palm trees age and palm trees I read it wrong. Bati v'dikli bati, dikli v'iloni, if it's a choice between palm trees and other kinds of trees, dikli, then you buy palm trees. The opposite, actually. Palm trees last longer. palm trees last longer, and therefore there's going to be a longer time when the when there's a use for keren, and you're getting paid for it. Iloni v'gufni. What if it's a choice between other kinds of trees and grapevines? Iloni, then you buy other kinds of trees, because again, grapevines age faster than other kinds of trees. So all of that. Now, Rashi explains that the next line over here is not a continuation of that. It's rather a different thing. So far, we've established some basic concepts that when we have a choice between an asset that's going to depreciate and one that's going to depreciate less, then we get the one that's going to depreciate less. Now, the Gemara is going to point out a different kind of thing. So according to Rashi, the next line is not directly related to what we said before. It's going to talk about another case. We'll say in a minute, Tosfos is going to learn differently. So Abba Zrata, suppose that she inherited a forest of zradta. A zradta is a kind of tree that it produces fruit. It produces a small type of apples, but they're not a very choshev of fruit. People don't usually eat them. So mainly, such trees are used for their wood. So now, is that considered peiros, or is it considered keren? Peiros de kavri, or if she inherited a pond with fish in it. So amri la peira. So some of the Chachamim say that if she inherited then the wood in this forest or the fish in this pond, then the wood or the fish themselves would be considered the pri, and the area of the forest and or the pond itself would be considered the keren. Others say the whole thing is considered the keren, because after all, the wood or the fish eventually are going to get all used up. So in other words, it's one thing, peiros of karka, the karka is going to continue producing peiros every year, but the forest is not, unless you replant it, it's not going to continue producing wood. The fish pond is not going to continue producing fish. What if you take out all the fish, for example? Like this, for example, with a field, you can harvest all the peiros, and next year it'll grow peiros again if you plant it. A fish pond, you'd have to constantly restock. No, but right, but still, if you cut them all down, then they're gone. So some say that the whole thing is considered keren. So therefore, again, we have to sell that asset and use that to buy other character that we can get normal payers from. And then, so klolad milsa. So the general rule would be gizay machlef payra. When you have something where if you chop it down, it'll regenerate. For example, produce in a field. Let's say you harvest grain from the field, but the next year more grain will grow. So then it's considered payers. In gizay machlef. But if you have something where the actual trunk doesn't regenerate, for example, a tree, or you cut down a tree, the tree's not going to regrow. Karna, then it's considered keren itself. So all of that is how Rashi learns that last line. Tosfos brings from Rabbeinu Hananel that has the gusa the other way around. Gizei machlef, if it regenerates, then it's considered keren. Ein gizei machlef, and if it doesn't regenerate, then it's considered peiros. So Tosfos also explains that when we said about the Abba Zradta and Peira de Kavri, it is a continuation of before. Before we were saying that, before we were talking about various things, if he wants to buy land, she wants to buy a house, etc. So now we're continuing, and we're saying that we're talking about if she, for example, the husband wants to buy a forest of zradta trees or a fish pond, then does that work or not? Is that considered peiros or is that considered keren? So according to that, then it's a direct continuation of what we said before. Okay. Another din in this connection, Amr of Zera, Amr of Oshia, Amr of Yanai, Ba'amila, Amr of Abba, Amr of Oshia, Amr of Yanai. So the first version is Rav Zera is saying it, and then the second one is Rav Abba is saying it. Hagunev talking more about this matter of Mixa Malug. Hagunev Vlad Behemas Malug. If a person steals a baby of an animal of Malug, so she has an animal of Mixa Malug. An animal is also, you have Keren and then you have Peter Smith, because over time the animal produces babies as well as milk and other things. So the milk or the babies or whatever are the Peter, and the animal itself is the Keren. So suppose then that somebody goes and steals a baby of such an animal, Meshalam Tashlomei Kefal Leisha. Who would he pay the Tashlomei Kefal? He would pay to the woman. So now it sounds like we're saying that the baby is considered the keren, and therefore that belongs to the woman, because if we consider it a peres on the face of it, then it should be going to the husband, right? So the question is, Kiman, well, who is this like in our Mishnah? Who is this like? Loy kudab bonan v'loy kachananya. This seems to be not like the Chachamim and not like Hananya, which in a Braisa that we're going to quote now, where the Chachamim and the Chachamim and Hananya disagree about a similar kind of case as far as Vlad Behemas Malug. So Tosfos points out, Marsha explains that, when you get down to the baby itself, it sounds like we're saying the babies themselves belong to the woman, because after all, if the mother animal dies, then you still have the baby still becomes the next keren. But on the other hand, you would say, as far as kefil, where what are you going to have? The baby and the mother are both going to die is very unlikely. And still, it sounds like we're saying that belongs to the woman. So it sounds like we're saying the whole thing is considered keren, but that doesn't fit according to either the Chachamim or Hananya. Titania, Vlad Behemas Malog Labal, the baby of a behema of Nichsim Malog belongs to the husband, because it's considered Paris. Vlad Shifchas Malog Laisha, but if it's, on the other hand, if you have a similar case with a Shifcha, she has, among her Nichsim Malog, she has a maidservant, and eventually that maidservant gives birth to a baby, then the Gemara is going to explain further on, why that actually belongs to her for reasons that we're going to explain soon. Hananya ben Achi Yoshi Amar, Hananya, the nephew of Yoshia, says also Vlad Shifchas Malog to Vlad Behemas Malog. No, the Chachamim treat the baby of a Shifcha of Nichsim Malog exactly like the baby of an animal of Nichsim Malog. So both the Chachamim and Hananya are agreeing that the baby of an animal is considered Paris and the husband gets it. The argument is only as far as the baby of a Shifcha, where the Chachamim say it belongs to her and Hananya says it belongs to him. So now if we're saying that if somebody steals this baby, the baby of the behema, then the kefil goes to the woman, why would that be? According to both the Chachamim and Hananya, it should go to him. The answer is, So the Gemara says, Afilu Tema Divrei Hakol. No, because you could say that Rabzeira's or Rab Abba's din works according to everybody. Peira takinu le rabbanon, peira to peira le takinu le rabbanon. Because the Chachamim made that the husband gets the peiris, the actual vlad, but peiris of peiris, the kefil that comes as the result of the vlad having been stolen, that the Chachamim weren't mistaken for him. Which doesn't mean, by the way, we're going to learn in the next parak, the husband is entitled to peiris of peiris. Eventually, if we take the peiris, for example, and sell them and use them to buy another asset, then the husband is entitled to peiris of those. We're going to talk about those dinim in the next parak. But what we mean is, in other words, that to begin with, something like this, where to begin with, this is Paris that come from Paris themselves, not as that meanwhile other Karen was bought with it, then we're saying that the Chachamim were not Masakin, that should belong to him. Therefore, fine, the Vlad itself might belong to him as Paris, but the Kefil that comes as a result of that Vlad would actually belong to her. Okay, so now let's analyze this Machlokas of Hananya and the Chachamim.
Not the brush now.
So then that's how we understand, that's how we say, therefore, the Braisa is not contradicting the din that we just said. Yes, we're saying according to both the Chachamim and Hananya, the baby itself belongs to the husband as Paris, but we're saying that the kefil from that baby is considered Paris of Paris, and that's not the kind of Paris that the Chachamim were masakin for him, only if we were to sell the Paris and use them to get another Karen, which then we'll have Paris from that, but not in a scenario like this. Okay, so now let's analyze this Braisa a little more. B'shleim al-Hananya, we understand according to Hananya that he says that both the baby animal and the baby Eved belong to the husband. So evidently what it is Hananya is not concerned about the possibility of death. You have over here, in other words, that Mephoshim explained that you would have to, in order for there to be a problem over here, in order for it to be that she's lost her Karen, it would have to be that both her husband dies before her, such as he's anyway getting the property back, and that the mother died, so now all she has is the baby. So fine. Hananya says that kind of thing is unlikely. Therefore the husband gets the blood. And if it turns out that the husband dies and that the shifcha died, it means she doesn't have her keren anymore. Okay, but that's how it is. Hananya considers that very unlikely. Ela Rabbanan, but according to the Chachamim, they seem to be inconsistent. If they have reason to be concerned about the possibility of death, of the husband dying, or of the mother animal, or mother shikla dying, after the Vlad Behemoth Malug Nami, then they should be saying that even the baby goes to the wife, Loi, should not go to the husband, but rather to the wife, because it's part of her Karen. And we want to preserve her Karen. The Eloi Chai Shilam Nisan, if they're not concerned about it, after the Vlad Shivcha Smolog Nami, then it should be the same thing with the baby of a Shivcha. Why are they distinguishing between a baby animal and a baby of a Shivcha? The answer is La'olam Chai Shilam Nisa. The answer is we can say the Chachamim are in fact concerned about Nisa, so we do want to preserve something of the asset for her. But the shiny behemoth, the ika oira. But it's one thing with an animal, even if the animal is dead, even if the mother animal dies, you still have the skin. So therefore, it's not like the entire keren is gone. Fine, though she has a lot less keren than she did, because before she had a live animal. Now all she has is the skin. But nevertheless, she still does have something of keren. Actually, Tosfos wonders about that. I mean, the fact is, we don't say, for example, that the husband would have the right to shech the animal and say, well, I'll consider the meat of it the payrus, and you can keep the skin. Obviously, he doesn't have the right to do that. But still, we're saying, you know, the point is, in other words, still, that we were saying though that so Tosfos wonders then how are we even considering the skin to be something left over, that we should consider it a leftover piece of the keren, but that seems to be what the Gemara is saying. As opposed to with a person, you can't do it because a person's skin is also bana. A person's skin has to be buried with them. It's also bana. Okay. So the Gemara says, "Amar of Huna Bachia, Amar
Shplay the slaves."
What?
How are you explaining the slaves?
So that's the thing. What we're saying is, therefore, the Chachamim are saying that if she has a shivcha and that shivcha gave birth to a baby, we're saying, given that if the shivcha dies and the husband were to keep the baby, then she has no keren at all. Because after all, she does nothing from the shivcha that she can keep. Therefore, we want her to keep the baby. That way, at least she'll have some continuing care. As opposed to with an animal. We don't need that, because even if the mother animal dies, she can still keep the skin. Okay. So the Gemara says, Omer of Huna Bachia, Omer Shmuel, Halacha Kechananya. The Halacha is like Chananya, that both the Vlad of the shivcha and the Vlad of the baby belong to the husband. But Omer Rava, Omer of Nachman, Afal Gavra, Omer Shmuel, Halacha Chananya, even though Shmuel is telling us that Halacha is like Chananya, Moed Chananya, Chananya does agree, She'im Nisgarsha, that if she gets divorced, Nesenes Damim and Etzlasan, that she can give the husband has to, if she wants, take money from her and get back the Shifcha. Because of the reputation of her father's house. We're going to learn in the next Mishnah that you have when she, there's certain kinds of assets when she brings them into the marriage, it's a shevach, it's a thing of her parents' dignity, of honor for them, that they were able to give her, she was able to inherit or whatever, such a valuable asset. So avodim and shvachah. So in that category, so therefore, so she is entitled to that eved or shivcha back, and therefore, so fine. The husband is entitled to the vlad. But if she gets divorced, then she has the right to say, you know what, shevach beisavia. I want this eved or this shivcha to stay in my family, and therefore he has to be willing to accept money from her for that. Okay, the Gemara says another din. Omer Rava, Omer of Nachman, Hichnisaloi Ez Vachalava. Suppose that she brought in, as Nichsim Balung, a goat as far as the milk. Now Rashi explains that we're talking about that the animal actually belongs to her, and the deal is, in other words, that now this animal can be milked, and that's going to be its payus. A number of Rishonim learn differently, actually. They say we're talking about that she herself doesn't own the animal, but she inherited the rights to the milk of this animal. It could happen, you know, a person wondering if Reuven owns an animal, he sold the milk supply of it to Shimon. So now if Shimon dies without any sons, let's say, and his daughters are inheriting, so now she inherited that she's entitled to the milk of this animal. So that's how that a number of Rishonim learned that way. Anyway, the Rochel Gizasa, or it was a sheep as far as the shearing. Again, according to Rashi, we're talking about she owns the sheep, and we're saying the shearing is the payrus. According to the other Rishonim, we're saying the shearing itself is what she owns, the actual wool of it. But trying to go less the beit sasa, or a chicken as far as its eggs, the deckle of payrosav, or palm tree as far as its fruit. So then, the husband, since he's entitled to peiros, he can continue eating until the keren is gone. Meaning, in other words, for example, let's say, in the first case, the goat for the milk, he can continue to milk the goat as long as it's alive. Eventually the animal is going to die. Like we said before, you have the skin left of it. So therefore she has something of the keren left. And the same thing with each of these other things. The chicken you still have. The feathers are left. The tree, when it dries up, you have the wood, etc. So therefore the keren is not completely gone. According to the other Rishonim, the vote would be that we're saying that he's entitled to that milk. That milk is not considered keren, even though that's the only asset she owns from the animal. She doesn't own the actual animal itself, only the milk. Nevertheless, that's considered peiros, and to the extent that he can continue having it. Amar Rav Nachman, Ayvila Glima, similarly, Rav Nachman says if she brought into the marriage a garment, then the same thing, peira habi, the garment, the fact that the garment can be worn is the peiros. Therefore, machasi, they've also had the kalya. So therefore, he can continue wearing it until it wears out. And when eventually it wears out, then the leftover pieces of it will go to her.
So the milk continues.
So we said the husband is entitled to the milk as long as the animal's alive. Once it's dead, then fine. She'll have the skin of the animal. So now Rav Nachman's saying in a similar vein that if it's a garment, then the fact that the garment can be worn is considered the payers of it. So therefore, again, he can continue wearing it as long as the garment is still wearable. And when not, then the rags that are left of it, those are the keren, and she gets those. Same as the skin of the animal, let's say. So the Gemara says, Kiman ki haitan. Now, who is this going like the following time? The Tanya, Hamelach Bahafoil, suppose that she inherited a place by the seashore where you get salt. So in those days, the usual way of making salt was you'd dig ditches near the sea, salt water would go into the ditches, then you'd close up the ditch, the water would evaporate, you'd be left with salt. So there's actually a place in Rashi brings from a pasuk in Yeshua that mentions a place where at one point one of the battles between the Jewish people and the Canaanim was in a place called Misrafos Mayim, which literally means the burning of water. That's what it means. There was a place near the seashore like that where they would evaporate the water in order to get salt. So suppose she inherited such a thing, b'hachol, or she inherited a place where you get sand that can be used for building, hareis haperis, then the salt or the sand are considered peiros. So we don't say we sell that area and we buy karka that can be planted, because after all, the peiros of it are going to continue forever. As long as you keep on having the ditches, then you will continue getting salt from it. As long as this is a place you're going to get sand from, there's an inexhaustible supply of sand. On the other hand, pirshol gofris. On the other hand, if she inherited a mine from which you extract sulfur, machboiras shel tzrif, or she inherited a mine from which you get alum, which is a mineral that they used in those days for dyeing and for other purposes. So Rav Meir or the keren, the chamer and peiros, Rav Meir says it's considered keren because eventually all of the sulfur or all of whatever it is, whatever mineral you're extracting from this mine is going to be gone. And the chum, so therefore Rav Meir says you consider it keren, and the chum say that the mineral itself is considered the peiros, and the mine itself, the location itself, is considered the keren. So therefore the chamer are going to say again that he can continue mining sulfur or alum or whatever from it. If the sulfur or the alum gets used up, okay. Nevertheless, though, she still has a hole in the ground, which is her asset. So the difference is the salt, you're going to continue having salt there forever. As opposed to this, eventually the mineral that's in this mine gets used up. So nevertheless, the Chachamim are saying that this is the normal way of using it. So it's the same thing as a piece of clothing. It's one thing, in other words, it actually explains that it's one thing, for example, we talked about, let's say in the Mishnah, that you have, let's say, fruit that was detached from the ground, there's no peiros that those produce. This mine does at least produce peiros. Fine, it's not forever, but at least it produces peiros, and therefore we can consider it. Okay, so the Gemara finishes off. Rav Shimon and Makom Shigafa Koichai. We said Rav Shimon gave that rule about when the husband has a greater power or lesser power, Peiros Tlushin versus Peiros Machabarin. So the Gemara asked Rav Shimon, Hainu Tanakama. Isn't he effectively saying the same thing as the Tanakama? He's just restating it in other language. The answer is Amar Rav Machabarin Mishas Yitzia Ikabinayu. The Naftamina between the Chachamim and Rav Shimon would be as far as when they're attached to the ground when he divorces her. The Chachamim did not address that. So the Chum did not address that. They would say whatever grew in his Rishus is considered his. So since it grew in his Rishus, then he's entitled to it. Whereas Reb Shimon would be saying that that we consider these part of the Karen, and therefore she's entitled to them. Rashi points out, we can't say that they're arguing about Tolush Peshas Yitzia, because of course, once they're detached from the ground, no question, they're considered Peiris, so the only Machlokas could be when they're still attached to the ground when he divorces her.
Even though he did the work,
but nevertheless, they're still attached to the ground, so the Chachamim are going to consider it, part of the Peiris, so therefore they're his, Reb Shimon is going to consider it part of the Keren, and therefore it's hers. Okay, everyone.